Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk from Sunday, November 17th is by Judith Schwartz on the topic of Do the Improbable, an Earth Healing Journey.
Hello, everyone. Great to see you all. A lot of familiar faces. And as Bruce said, I'm a writer, a journalist who explores nature-inspired solutions for global challenges. Now, it hasn't always been that way. That hasn't always been my beat. And it changed in a very, like, at pretty much a specific moment. Okay. So a while back, I was writing about new economics, which is the notion that the economy should serve people and the planet instead of the other way around. So, you know, I was writing all these articles, you know, is the GDP the best measure of prosperity? Why does nature have a value of zero in our economic system? And I wrote about a movement called Slow Money, which is at once a critique of our financial system and how it's, you know, how money, wealth moves ever more quickly in ever more abstract, marginal amounts chasing speculative profits. So it's a critique of the economic system and an effort to bring money down to earth into the community so that it circulates in the community and supports, like, you know, small local enterprises. Specifically, they were working on, or they've been working on, food enterprises, farming and local products, etc. And so their national gathering was up in Shelburne. And I thought, oh, I can do that. I can drive up there. So I went, you know, I went with my notebook and really interested in all the economics. And then there was this guy who was talking about soil. And I was thinking, okay, soil, yeah, I get it. It's a metaphor for community engagement, for place, sense of place. But he was really talking about soil. And he made a statement that just would not let me go. And that was that over time, more carbon had been released from the soil, from agricultural practices, fallowing, plowing, improper grazing, than fossil fuels. And that hit me over the head because I thought, wait, I thought I knew what was going on, and I thought this was all about fossil fuels. So I started researching soil. And when I, you know, I was doing my other things, and then I kind of like was keeping a little notebook on soil, and it hit me, oh my gosh, restoring soil can help us with climate, biodiversity, food security, human health, local economies. Like, oh my gosh. So I wrote a book about soil. But back then, the only people who were talking about the soil climate connection were people in the realm of holistic management. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this. That's the use of, or holistic plant grazing, the use of grazing animals as a vehicle to restore large grassland ecosystems. I'm just curious, have any of you heard of holistic management? Okay. And Alan Savory? Okay. I'm going to mention him in a bit. But anyway, the notion of animals as agents of restoration is why I chose the cheeky title, Cows Save the Planet, and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. So when I was thinking about what I was going to talk about, I reflected on the titles of my three books. And one word struck out to me as being especially important, not hope, although I am kind of a hope junkie, but the word improbable. That's because nature's patterns, and therefore the solutions we can tap into, are often counterintuitive. In our culture, we are trained to see processes as linear, and what makes sense in a complex system may seem improbable in a linear world, like cattle being of benefit to our landscapes. When we encounter the improbable and stay with it, turn it around in our hands and look at it in a different light, we stretch our imagination and discover new possibilities. The improbable idea that compels me now, improbable only because of the linear way that climate is talked about, is the extent to which nature creates and manages climate. That is the idea that animates my three books, although I didn't really understand that until recently. What I did understand is that nature's role in regulating climate was missing from the climate conversation, and that when we bring it into the conversation, we are bringing in hope. That's right, that other word. Because we know we can rehabilitate even extensive damaged ecosystems so we can restore some of that climate regulation capacity. So I'm going to shift gears now and take a look at some of these improbable examples, courtesy of nature. So we'll start with holistic planned grazing. And you know, his work was my first introduction to the improbable. Alan Savory is a fellow from, gosh, I just talked to him recently. He's about to turn 90, but he's still pretty feisty and goes back and forth to Zimbabwe. So he's from what was Rhodesia and is now Zimbabwe. And he loved wildlife. And I really understand that because my husband is from South Africa and grew up wanting to be a game ranger, just like Alan did. So Alan, when he went into the service helping to, create the national parks, he observed that the wildlife was less vibrant and numerous than what he remembered, and wondered why that was. And what the conventional wisdom was, oh, there must be too many animals. But then when they fenced it off so animals couldn't come in, the land deteriorated. So something else was going on, and he devoted his life to understanding that and understanding what solutions might be. So he developed the holistic management framework based on three core insights: that grasslands and grazing animals co-evolved so that the land needs the animals in the same way that the animals need the land, that land can be undergrazed as well as overgrazed, and this is really key when we look at the global scenario, that not all land behaves the same. Brittle landscapes, those with distinct dry and rainy seasons, have the challenge of keeping moisture in the soil from the end of one rainy season to the beginning of the next. And the solution that nature came up with was via the digestion and behavior of ruminant animals. So I just want to pause for a second, because brittle landscapes. So we live in a non-brittle landscape in that we have moisture fairly regularly throughout the year, although except that's kind of changing a little bit now. But so anyway, it's a different scenario, because in places where there are, there's a distinct rainy season and dry season, it really is a challenge to keep that land alive. And if you look at a map and if you look at what's happening globally, that a lot of that land is desertifying, which means it can no longer sustain life. But so, I think about that the way that nature solved that problem is through animals distributing moisture and fertility and pressing down decaying plant matter so it's incorporated into the soil rather than drying out. So this allowed Alan to come to the unlikely conclusion that what caused the land health decline in Northern Rhodesia's national parks was not that there were too many animals, but rather that there were too few. I had the incredible privilege to visit the Africa Center for Holistic Management in Zimbabwe and learn on the ground from Alan, to sit around the fire in the cool of the evening, listening to the sounds of birds and animals and hearing stories from a remarkable life. Alan modeled the importance of paying attention to signals in the landscape to observe life's subtle choreographies. Likely, he was primed for his insights by being an expert tracker. Witnessing his deep attunement to his surroundings was a revelation. He could read marks and patterns on the soil surface that revealed whether the giraffe that made them was a bull or a cow, and whether it was seeking water or escaping a predator. He could discern the shift in the types of grass that suggested an improvement in land health, specifically grasses that depend on animal impact, as opposed to grasses that depend on fire or depend on bare ground. Living things tend to perpetuate the conditions under which they thrive, and land that is fire prone or lacking ground cover is less vital than land that supports animal life. The point is that nature is self-regulating and self-healing in complex ways that might not be obvious to us. But by suspending our desire to make things simple, like believing that cows are good or cows are bad, we can observe the dynamics of a given ecosystem and align our actions with nature rather than against her. Okay, so now we're going to move to a whole other example, and this is in Australia. So this is a case that I've been following for many, many years. The donkeys of Kachana Station in the Kimberley. Donkeys were brought to Australia as pack animals in the 1800s as settlers moved into remote areas in the outback. When mechanized transport came in, the donkeys were set loose. They became wild and formed bands. The powers that be said, donkeys are not native to Australia, so by definition, they are pests, especially because sometimes they do naughty things like knock down fences. In the large rural state of Western Australia, the authorities said that donkeys must be eradicated and shot from the air. Now, hang on, farmer Chris Hengler would say, and that's something he always says. I love talking to Chris because when he says, now hang on, he's going to say something that completely upends, you know, most people's assumptions. Hengler, Chris, manages an area of land the size of the five boroughs of New York, or the size of Singapore. You can take your analogy, in the Kimberley. It's a place that you can only get to by helicopter. Hengler and his family have been working since the 1990s to restore the land with cattle using holistic management. And their biggest challenge in the Kimberley is fire. It's pretty intense out there. Now, when the donkeys showed up, they realized that the donkeys went to areas that the cattle wouldn't go. They went where there was rough terrain and often, you know, up at the, rocky terrain and at like the, beginning of rivers. So, and they helped keep the grasses low, and they helped keep, they browsed and helped keep the drying out leaves under control. They also realized that they could herd the donkeys to encourage this behavior. In short, the donkeys became an important part of their fire crew. So this has been going on for several years, with the government insisting that Chris call the donkeys, and Chris and his supporters, which includes me, striving to educate various officials. In the meantime, Chris and several scientists who study megafauna, and if I were going to start over again, I would go into megafauna studies because I think it's so interesting. There's a center in Denmark, in Aarhus, where they do megafauna research. It's really, they do great work. So they have learned a number of improbable things. Donkeys, and I'll just list them off. Donkeys and other animals not native to a place are often unstudied and therefore invisible to most scientists. I mean, why would you study donkeys in Australia? Wouldn't you study kangaroos or wombats? I mean, studying these animals' impact on the land reveals that they are filling an ecological niche which has been void since the end of the late Pleistocene, when Australia lost its megafauna, like the Dipetron giant wombats. There was a whole Tasmanian tiger. There were a whole bunch of really wild-looking creatures. And they disappeared, or they became extinct like 40 or 50,000 years ago. So, and that is what Chris was observing, that these, invisible megafauna are browsing and cycling vegetation so that it doesn't become fire fuel. The donkeys dig wells, which creates a water resource for other wildlife. This fills a niche that giant wombats occupied tens of thousands of years ago. Their habit of moving brush around creates habitat for small marsupials like rock wallabies, which have been struggling. While the fate of Kachana's donkeys remain in the balance, what the Henglers do know is that land where the donkeys are is healthier than land without. And kind of exciting, of course, it was just a couple of days before the election, Australian Story, which is like in Australia, what 60 Minutes used to be here, like, you know, the show that everybody watches, they featured Chris, his family, and the donkeys, and they really emphasized the love story of Chris and his wife Jackie holding their own in the outback and raising their children there. I mean, it's really quite a story. Now I'm going to mention one last example, and this one's a little hard to kind of. It's much more sciencey, so bear with me. This is about something called the biotic pump, which is a natural function of forests. Now, when we think of the word forest, we're usually thinking in terms of a noun. But if we change our lens and think about forests from the standpoint of a verb, taking an improbable perspective, our understanding of what forests do opens up dramatically. Mm-hmm. So I've been following the biotic pump. Has anyone heard of the biotic pump?
No.
Okay, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. There's basically one publication that's been following this particular branch of science, and that's a publication called Manga Bay, which is like reporting from the front lines of nature. They do incredible work. They have reporting offices all around the world, in India and Brazil, and then they have reporters all over the world. So this is a theory that was developed by Russian physicists Viktor Gorshkov, who is no longer alive, and Anastasia Makarieva, who is very much alive, who even has been here in Bennington and enjoyed it. She loved it here. So in early April, I was fortunate to take part in the first Biotic Pump International Conference at the Technical University of Munich. So the biotic pump, I'll do this as quickly as I can. Anastasia and Victor were posing the question, if ultimately all rain comes from the ocean, how do places far from the ocean get rain? So they did all this research and went to the Amazon and all these calculations that I could not even dream of being able to decipher. They determined that when forests transpire, you know, upward movement. Okay, they send up moisture, and this creates a low pressure zone. You know, when it condenses, creates a low pressure zone, which pulls in moisture from, horizontally. So it drives the movement of moisture around the world. And they, biotic scientists, including, Antonio Nobre from Brazil, predicted that this is kind of bad for the Amazon because we're losing forests there. And indeed, we are seeing droughts there. And then what I also recently learned is that the vertical movement is, so the point is that when we lose the biotic pump function, it falls off. There's a threshold and it falls off. And in terms of temperature, when the biotic pump is functioning, so it's like with transpiration, it's as though the plants are harvesting heat and releasing it higher up. That's, the transpiration condensation cycle, because transpiration consumes heat. So it's harvesting the heat. And when the biotic pump is working, then the moisture and the, you know, the it's the heat is embodied in it's latent heat in the water vapor. And when the biotic pump is working, it's then sent out to space because it is released, the heat is released higher up. But when the biotic pump isn't working, it kind of sits around at a lower level where it interacts with greenhouse gases. So that's the heat. So anyway, I thought that was really kind of important. And just one other thing, and then I'm finishing up. So what Anastasia was talking about in Munich, she was talking about climate sensitivity, which is something we don't hear much about. Climate sensitivity is the amount of warming per increase in CO2. And what she said is that we have a lot of agency because healthy natural ecosystems provide a buffer with that heat. With the transpiring and, with all those processes. So there's a lot we could do. I think, I mean, when you think about it, if you have, a landscape with asphalt, sidewalks, parking lots, et cetera, that is likely to be hotter than, a meadow and a forest. So anyway, I thought the climate sensitivity point was kind of important, that it would serve us all to bring that into the conversation. So the conventional, now I'm finishing up. I know I've thrown a lot out here and I'm happy to answer any questions. The conventional wisdom is that climate trends of warming and cooling center on CO2. The different view, and therefore improbable in our current context, is that Earth has an exquisitely fine-tuned system for regulating temperature and moisture that is driven by the life that dwells here, the flora, fauna, and fungi, and the interactions among them. This improbable perspective has real-world consequences, which have remained invisible because it doesn't fit the accepted narrative. So I'm happy to hear your thoughts.